From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, take two aspirin and listen. We talk about headaches, the causes and cures with Dr. Fred Cheftel. His latest book focuses on women, hormonal changes, and headaches. Cheftel is the co-founder of the New England Center for Headache. Contrary to popular myth, he says headaches aren't caused by personality defects or stress, but by electrical and biochemical processes in the brain. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Atticus, the new novel by Ron Hansen, author of the bestseller Marriott in Ecstasy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Texas Senator Phil Graham today pulled out of the race for the Republican presidential nomination. After poor showings in early tests in Iowa and Louisiana, Graham said today in Washington his goal now is to become a great senator. Graham said he wasn't ready to throw his support behind any of the eight remaining contenders, but it sounds like he won't back fellow conservative Pat Buchanan.
I believe that Pat Buchanan's stand on protectionism is at variance with our party's commitment to job creation and to freedom. I've spoken out very strongly on that subject. I know there is support in both parties, from Dick Gephardt to Pat Buchanan, for protectionism. In fact, there has always been a recessive gene in the American character that has found protectionism appealing. But we have always been wise enough to reject it, and I reject it now, and I always will reject it.
Graham becomes the third candidate to quit following California Governor Pete Wilson and Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter. GOP contender Lamar Alexander today won the backing of former Education Secretary William Bennett. Bennett told NBC that Alexander is a good man with winning ideas, a combination that Bennett says will beat President Clinton in November. The 1996 Economic Report on the President is released today. As Steve Beckner on Market News Service reports, it advances the administration's case for lower interest rates to keep the economy from slipping.
For the most part, President Clinton and his advisors have refrained from the kind of pressure his predecessor put on the Fed. But with the election approaching and the economy slowing, that may be changing. The report which the President's Council of Economic Advisors prepared for Clinton to send to Congress says the Fed needs to reduce short-term interest rates. The Fed has cut rates three times since last July, but with inflation at 3% and unemployment at 5.8%, the report says the Fed could lower rates further to create more jobs with little risk of driving up prices. Though there is no agreement on a balanced budget, the report says the Fed should ease monetary policy as fiscal policy tightens. If not, it warns the economy will slow further. The report gives the Fed little credit for having brought down inflation and long-term interest rates. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
Opening statements are complete in the double murder trial of John Salvi. Prosecutors say Salvi, who is accused in the shooting deaths of two abortion clinic workers in Massachusetts, is guilty of extreme atrocity and cruelty. Salvi's defense lawyers say he was delusional and schizophrenic at the time of the shootings. The nighttime split shift will be eliminated by the New Jersey Transit Authority on one of the lines involved in Friday's fatal train collision, but officials say the change is not an acknowledgement that split shifts are dangerous. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 22 points at 5579.19. You're listening to NPR News. In Mexico, Zapatista Indian rebels said today that an overwhelming majority of their supporters in Chiapas State have agreed to sign a first peace accord with the Mexican government after 10 months of negotiation. The Agreement on Indian Rights and Culture is the first in a series of six accords to be worked out between the government and the rebels to end the Zapatista conflict, which began 2 years ago. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has gone to his hometown, where he's expected to announce his decision to run for re-election. NPR's Ann Gerrels has more.
The 65-year-old Russian president may be in poor health. His ratings are terrible, but everything else points to a decision to stand in the June 16th elections. Yekaterinburg, where he was once the Communist Party secretary, was one of the very few places where the pro-Yeltsin centrist bloc defeated the communists in December's parliamentary elections. But even though Yeltsin's popularity is much higher in Yekaterinburg than elsewhere, polls indicate only 17% there now support him. In anticipation of tomorrow's announcement, the city's been spruced up. The president's staff has brought in celebrities, and Yeltsin arrived vowing to push on with reforms. He suggested only he can ensure the continuation of reforms given the resurgence of the communists. Communist leader Gennady Zyuganov is also expected to launch his campaign tomorrow. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Rescue workers in Japan brought in heavy earth-moving equipment today now that a massive boulder blocking a highway tunnel has been reduced to rubble. 20 people have been trapped in the tunnel for 4 days and are feared dead. Crews need 4 dynamite blasts over as many days to break the rock slab, but even with the boulder gone, officials say it could take several days to dig out the debris at the site outside a remote cliffside village about 550 miles north of Tokyo. There appears to be a new record for the fastest trip around the world. A Learjet, flown by former astronaut and 3 other pilots, landed in Denver today after finishing the trip in over 49 hours. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Headaches. Sometimes they're just a mild throbbing that annoys you as you go about your daily business. Sometimes they hurt so much you have to give up and lie down. My guest, Dr. Fred Cheftel, is an expert on headaches. He joined us before on the show, but we invited him back to update us on the latest information on the causes and treatment of headaches. Dr. Cheftel's new book is called Headache Relief for Women, and a little later we'll talk about how hormonal changes during the menstrual cycle and menopause can affect headaches. Dr. Cheftel is co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and national president of the American Council for Headache Education, known as ACHE. He says the latest research on migraines focuses on biochemical and electrical activity in the brain. For example, scientists are learning about the role of serotonin.
Serotonin is a biochemical that's found throughout the body and in the brain and seems to be a very, very important part of what's involved with migraine. There are many other chemical messengers or neurotransmitters that are involved, but a lot of focus has been on serotonin. Serotonin is a chemical that's available in the brain and is a neurotransmitter and seems to be disturbed in patients with migraine. It may either be a disturbance of the receptors themselves on nerve terminals or blood vessels, or it may be a disturbance in serotonin itself, the molecule. Well, there's a study that was just done in Europe by Dr. Diener and his group using a PET scan, which shows function of the brain. You see, CT scans and MRI scans show only structure. So in this particular examination, he looked at 8 or 9 migraine patients who were suffering acute attacks and saw this exact part of the brain light up and show excessive activity during the migraine attack. And when the migraine attack began to die down, so did this activity. So it's just confirming a lot of kind of hypothetical notions we've had based on our clinical evidence about what's going on with migraine. Some of the other advances are advances in outlining more of the receptors in the brain that are involved in migraine and some of the chemicals that are involved. There's a lot of advances in the area of molecular biology. There's been advances in the genetics of headache as well. So all these things together are just increasing the level of awareness and knowledge about the basic biological or neurobiological roots of migraine, which is clearly both a biochemical, neurological, and electrical phenomenon that's involved in the brain.
Okay, so scientists are pretty sure now that migraines are caused by electrical or biochemical processes within the brain, yes?
Both electrical and biochemical changes in the brain involving, at least on some levels, these chemical messengers in the brain that we call neurotransmitters.
Now, what would set this off?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Well, number one, it seems that patients with migraine have more excitability of nerve activity in their brain, and they're more prone to having this process set off. We know genetics and families play a big role in this. 70% to 90% of people with migraine have a first-degree relative of it with it. Now, we know that there are certain triggers that can ignite this process, and there are a whole host of triggers. Exactly how they do it, we're not sure about. But we know that hormones certainly is a key factor in women. We know that diet can play a role. We know that changes in one's external or internal environment, external like weather, seasons, time zones, schedule changes, things of that sort.
And we'll get to more of those triggers in more detail a little later in our conversation. Now, a lot of people assume that people who are prone to bad headaches are just incredibly neurotic, and that's why they get them. So the more we know about brain chemistry, can we rule out the neurotic stuff?
I think so. I think, why don't we say the same things about people who develop ulcers or asthma or ulcerative colitis or angina or heart disease or hypertension or diabetes? You know, there's no disorder in the world where stress and psychological factors can't play a role. I can't think of any. For example, diabetics. When diabetics go through times of physical or emotional stress, their insulin requirements change. It's no less or more true of a disorder like migraine. And I think that's been a really bad rap that people with migraine have gotten over the years. I've spoken to people whose children, for example, have an aggressive version of migraine called chronic daily headache, who even relatives and friends have said, well, your 28-year-old daughter just won't grow up, and that's the issue, as if people are using this horrible pain as some kind of excuse. Now, there's no question that people who happen to have, side-by-side with migraine, major psychological problems, that those problems don't affect their disorder. But again, that's true of everything else. I think in that sense, people with migraine, particularly women, have really been maligned as far as that's concerned. And especially women can't win.
Can you give us a real layperson's version about what's going on in the brain when you have a headache?
Yeah, there are various centers of the brain that are involved. The higher centers of the brains where we think, is called the cortex. The higher centers of the brain are involved with sensation and movement. We know, for example, that people who have the aura before migraine, that the changes are occurring in brain, electrical changes in the back of the brain, which controls vision. And then as this proceeds, these events then get down to lower centers of the brain. The hypothalamus, which is the captain of a lot of automatic functions, are involved. The midbrain is involved. The brainstem is involved. And the final common pathway, Terry, is when all of these events culminate in changes in blood vessel activity. And two things happen to those blood vessels. They become dilated and they become inflamed. And that increases the signals of pain back up to the higher centers of the brain. Now, as it goes back through that pathway to the parts of the brain that perceive sensation and pain, it's then interpreted again at the higher centers of the brain, which then brings into roles our personalities, our all the things that make us what we are in terms of how we deal with and respond to the pain. In migraine, other centers of the brain are activated, which produce the nausea and vomiting that are associated with a fair percentage of folks with migraine. So, you know, again, we are really talking about a fairly complex biological, biochemical, electrical problem. The way I like to talk about it is migraine is a debilitating disorder of the central nervous system.
Now, we usually experience headache as a throbbing or a pounding or a tightening around the head. Is anything like that actually happening physiologically, or is that just the way we're interpreting what's happening?
Well, I think the throbbing sensation that's associated with migraine is indeed associated with blood vessel activity. As the blood begins to pound and move through the large blood vessels of the head, it stretches the walls of those blood vessels and the nerve endings in it. And in fact, when we time that pulsating feeling to our pulse or our heartbeat, it matches in migraine patients. At the same time, there's a decrease in the anti-pain chemicals in the brain that we need. So those two events are occurring side by side. Now, as far as the aching, squeezing feeling that a lot of people get with tension-type headache, that seems to maybe be related to muscle activity around the head and neck. But here again, we get complicated because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that in people who have migraine and also tension-type headache, that there is a common biology that the two disorders share, but it's a matter of volume. In other words, at the lower volumes, we perceive this low-grade, squeezing, aching, pressure-type pain. But as you turn the volume up on this generator in the brain, that's when you start to get more symptoms like throbbing and nausea and such.
What's new in the realm of pain relief now that scientists believe more and more that headaches are caused by electrical and biochemical changes in the brain? Are there any new drugs that address those changes within the brain?
Well, as we've identified a part of the migraine process, which involves a very important nerve in the head, the fifth nerve or trigeminal nerve, which is named such because it has three divisions, we're beginning to identify more of the receptors and more of the biochemicals in the brain that appear to be involved with migraine. Now, Imitrex or sumatriptan was developed on the basis of some of those receptors which involve serotonin. A lot more work has been done to identify other types of medication that will be coming out over the next several years that will also be similar to Imitrex, but perhaps quicker acting, longer acting, less side effects. But as we look at other receptors that don't involve changes in blood vessels, but that can reverse the migraine process, we'll be coming on to medications that have the potential for greater safety and less side effects. And so the research that's being done worldwide, and particularly by Mike Moskowitz at Harvard, has been nothing short of excellent in terms of what the future will bring for migraine patients. We're also looking at pain receptors in the brain. We're looking at pain medications that may be helpful in reversing pain without causing the problems of tolerance or addiction, because there are different pain receptors up there as well. Most people are familiar with what's called mu receptors or morphine-like receptors, but there are other receptors that can affect pain that don't involve becoming dependent or addicted to medication, and those are being explored now.
Now, if I understand you correctly, the latest medicines are dealing with changes in blood vessels, but not dealing with the changes in the brain that cause the changes in the blood vessels.
That's correct. That's exactly correct. And what we've been remiss in, and we'll be looking at even more closely, are medications that can be used preventatively to stop the process from occurring in the first place. I mean, there are many medications that are available now, but almost every one of these medications, with just one exception, were never developed specifically for migraine. It's a shame that in all the years that this disorder has existed, and especially since we've gotten better at looking at pharmacology, that we've only developed one medicine in the 1950s specifically for migraine. All of the rest of the medications that we use preventatively in migraine were developed for other disorders and then found to be helpful in migraine.
My guest is headache expert Dr. Fred Schefftel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Fred Schefftel. He's co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and he's also the national president of the American Council for Headache Education. And his latest book is Headache Relief for Women. Let's just review some of the things we talked a little bit about the last time, like what the difference is between a migraine headache and a tension headache, and, you know, does it matter if they're any different? I mean, do you need to know which kind you have?
I think so. I think that the diagnosis of the headache is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Very basically, we explain to our patients that we can divide all of headache problems into two major categories, what we've called primary and what we call secondary headache disorders. The secondary headache disorders, Terry, are the ones that are a symptom of some underlying medical problem where you can find the cause, identify it, and then hopefully remove the cause and then the headache. Now, the more serious causes are the ones that people start to worry about when they first get these headache problems, like tumors and bleeds and aneurysms, to less ominous problems such as sinus problems, dental problems, eye problems, and allergy problems. But there are many other medical problems like diabetes. There are many medications that can cause headache as a side effect. You want to rule those things out first, because if possible, you want to remove the cause and be able to then actually really realize a cure. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it, most headache disorders and most people with recurrent headache problems have one or more of the primary headache disorders. The primary headache disorders are by far the most common cause of recurrent headache in over 90% of people.
In other words, most people don't really have brain tumors when they have a bad headache.
Oh, thank goodness, no. They have headaches that are related to some of the biochemical issues that we were just discussing earlier. The three types of primary headache disorders are migraine, tension-type headache, and cluster.
And what's the difference?
Well, the difference is important because depending on the diagnosis, that's what you base treatment on. Migraine, we have very specific criteria for now. First of all, you've had to have had at least 5 previous episodes of this kind of pain. The pain generally lasts 4 to 72 hours, and you want to have ruled out organic factors like tumors, which may sometimes mimic migraine. Once you have that, we then look at 2 groups of symptoms, 2 from column A and 1 from column B. Here's column A. There are 4 symptoms here. The pain is one-sided, the pain is throbbing, the pain is moderate to severe and can interfere with or completely restrict your ability to function, and 4th, activity makes the headache worse, like exercise. For example, if I say to a patient with migraine, would you exercise during a migraine? They look at me like I'm completely out of my mind, and at that point I know I have the diagnosis clinched. So you need 2 of those and 1 of the following: the presence of nausea, the presence of vomiting, or sensitivity to both light and sound. So traditionally, the migraine patient will absolutely retreat to a dark and quiet room, avoid all sensory stimuli. Even the light from a clock radio can send shivers of pain through their bodies, and the least little sound will bother them as well. So they want to hibernate, and they want to sleep if they can. Actually, for centuries, we've known that sleep is an age-old, tried-and-true relief factor for migraine, and it probably relates to changes in serotonin that are brought on by sleep, where serotonin is restored as you go to sleep. So that's what migraine is, and it's a very debilitating disorder, affecting women 3 times more frequently than men. Actually, before puberty, though, it's more frequent in boys than girls. But as soon as hormonal issues become a problem, it goes up 3 to 1.
And how does migraine compare with what you'd call tension headache?
Well, I would say for the most part, in terms of the intensity of the pain and the associated symptoms of nausea and vomiting, it doesn't compare. And that's one of the reasons that migraine patients have felt abandoned and isolated and merely misunderstood. They really feel kind of apart from everybody else, because when they say the word headache, most people assume it's like the ordinary tension headaches that all of us get from time to time. 90 to 95% of us will have a headache from time to time. Tension headaches are mild to moderate, really, at best. It's more of a squeezing pain. It's more both-sided. It's more of an aching feeling that we may feel as a band around our head, or we may feel a cap-like sensation. It may go down to our neck and shoulders. There's no nausea. There's no vomiting. There's no sensitivity to both light and sound. Most people can function, though maybe at a little reduced capacity, and they relax or take an over-the-counter medication, and that's it. But you don't call into work. What happens if you call into work and you say to your boss, gee, I'm sorry, I can't come in today. I have a headache. What kind of response do you think you're going to get? Not a very good one. So migraine and tension type headache, though, are both classified as headache disorders. They are in absolutely 2 different worlds. They're galaxies apart.
But how do you know how to treat your headache?
Well, I think one of the things you want to do is you want to be careful about what kind of over-the-counter medication you're using and how frequently you're using it. I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Over-the-counter medications are clearly used by the majority of patients with headache, and they do very well with it, and they take care of themselves, and they don't overuse it. However, we have to understand that Americans purchase $3 billion worth of pain medication, $1 billion of which is for headache. Now, when you look at that market, we also have to remember, though we still use the word over-the-counter, it should not be used, because over-the-counter was a term that should have been abandoned 40 years ago, when it was a time in our lives, or people who were around at that time, would go to the pharmacist and say, Mr. Pharmacist, can I have a bottle of aspirin? Pharmacist would say, sure, here it is, but you know what? This is the 3rd bottle you've bought in 2 weeks. I think you ought to talk to your doctor. The only medicine that comes over the counter nowadays is prescription medication. What we're really talking about, Terry, is off the shelf. You can walk into any pharmacy, especially the large chain pharmacies, and find, you've seen it, 20-foot rolls of shelf, 5 feet high, with such an array of headache medications that it could give you a headache trying to make a decision about what to use. It's even worse than that, because we now know that the majority of these medications are no longer being purchased in pharmacies. They're being purchased in 7-Eleven stores, combo stores, supermarkets. So the availability of medical supervision is practically nil. And though over-the-counter medication, or off-the-shelf as I like to call it, is non-prescription, I think all of us have to remember that non-prescription medication is medication.
Well, I remember the last time we talked, you talked about something called the rebound headache.
Right.
Which means if you take over-the-counter, over-the-shelf, medication too often, that it can almost reinforce that headache pattern. And ever since then, every time I reach for a painkiller, you know, aspirin or Tylenol, I'm thinking, uh-oh, am I going to get a rebound headache? Am I taking too much, or am I under the threshold? So tell us what the rebound headache is and give us some guidelines.
Okay. The rebound headache occurs, there's about 3% of the population that has something called chronic daily headache. 80% of those people are overusing analgesic or pain-killing medication, be it by prescription or non-prescription. Two things happen. One, it absolutely will make the headache continue to be chronic, and two, it will get in the way of any non-medication or medication approach from working, and that's a problem. You really are trading in some short-term relief for keeping that disorder going. The pain of rebound is characterized by a waxing and waning pain that's there from practically morning till night, mild to moderate, and usually most of these patients have superimposed episodes of more severe headaches, which turn out to be migraine. So my advice is this. If you find yourself using the over-the-counter medications three or more times per week, or if you find that your headaches are significantly interfering with the quality of your life at work, home, and play, if you can't leave your house without a bottle of some over-the-counter medication in your purse or in your pocket,
yes.
I think then you might want to talk to your doctor about other approaches to it. So I think three or more times a week is when people should start to think about talking to their doctor about headaches. And by the way, one of the things we've known from some studies that have been done is that patients with headache do not even mention their headache to the primary care doctor until the last 2 minutes of their visit. And we know that a lot of patients bring up some of the most important things that they need to talk about at the end of the visit, so headache is then given short shrift. Advice to the listener. When you come into your doctor, if you have headaches that are bothering you, please bring it up at the front end of that interview or that visit. Let your doctor know that your headaches are bothering you. My advice to doctors in terms of interviewing patients who have headache is the first question they should ask is, do your headaches interfere with the quality of your life? Then if you get an answer, yes, they do. I'm taking non-prescription medications every day. Three times a month, I get so bad that I'm not able to work or take care of my responsibilities at home. At least the doctor now hears that you have a serious complaint. So don't add to what I would call the trivialization of headache by both physicians and the media.
Dr. Fred Cheftel is the co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and national president of AACE, the American Council for Headache Education. He's the co-author of the new book, Headache Relief for Women. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, prescription drugs that might help and foods that might hurt if you suffer from headaches. And how hormonal changes can affect women who are prone to headaches. We continue our discussion with headache expert Dr. Fred Schaftel. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel Atticus by Ron Hansen. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second half of our interview about headaches with Dr. Fred Schaftel. He's the co-author of the new book, Headache Relief for Women, and co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut. If you're trying to get a sense for yourself of whether you should be taking a prescription migraine medicine or whether over-the-counter remedies are good enough for you, how can you judge?
Well, I think you can judge, again, in terms of are you missing work? Are you missing time from work? Are you not functioning? Are you do you have to cancel social engagements? Are you afraid of upcoming social engagements or business commitments? You know, if that's the picture and you find that your over-the-counter medication may take the edge off of a little bit, but you find that you're using it over several days to just kind of take the edge off but still feeling pretty lousy, I think you ought to talk to your doctor about more specific remedies that we have available for these disorders, and there certainly are many nowadays.
Now, name a couple of the prescription remedies that you think are good and don't have a lot of side effects.
Okay. Well, first of all, in looking at the acute treatment of headache after you've made your diagnosis of migraine or tension-type headache, or cluster for that matter, start what I would call step-care therapy. Most of the time, by the time people have seen us, they've used over-the-counter medications without success, as we've just spoken about. But if you're looking at OTC medication, we can divide them up into simple analgesics or simple pain medications and the ones that are combined. The simple ones are single-ingredient medications. Those are Tylenol, Advil, Aleve, Arutis, aspirin. If those don't help you, you might consider a combined ingredient, which is Anacin, which has caffeine and aspirin, or Excedrin, which has caffeine, aspirin, and Tylenol in it. If those have not helped, then we go on to the more powerful medications, and I like to start again with the mildest. One of the medications that's very, very useful for both migraine and tension-type headache with minimal side effects is a medicine called Midrin. It has a couple of ingredients in it. It has Tylenol, a mild muscle relaxant in it, and something that helps to constrict blood vessels. And we use a lot of Midrin and find that to be very helpful and very well tolerated. It's an excellent medication for childhood migraine. Again, with children and migraine, you want to stay away from aspirin products because of Reye syndrome, but you can use the Tylenol type products. After Midrin, there's very useful medications that are well tolerated that contain a mixture of either aspirin or Tylenol, plus a little caffeine, plus butalbital or barbiturate. These medications have been around now for almost 50 years. They're very safe to use. They go by the brand names of Furanol, Furoset, or Estric. Now, these medications are useful. The problem with them, again, is them being overprescribed. I have seen really ridiculous prescriptions written for huge amounts of these medications, and patients don't know what to do with them and inadvertently start to overuse them and then come to us basically addicted. But if you use these medications occasionally, they can be excellent. Then there's a whole group of prescription non-steroidals, which if you don't have ulcer or hypertension, are very, very well tolerated. They go by the names of Anaprox or Naprosyn or Meclamin or Ansaid, and they can be very useful for both migraine and or tension-type headache. Even the simple narcotics, again used occasionally, like Tylenol with codeine, can be very helpful. It's the fact when you use these products too often that it's a problem.
Let me ask you about a dilemma I have. I have found that over-the-counter painkillers are most effective for me if I take it just as I feel the headache coming on.
Mm-hmm.
Once it's really struck, I've found, you know, aspirin and Tylenol stuff to be fairly useless.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I think I have a headache coming on, if I take something, I might be taking it for no good reason because maybe that headache isn't really going to come on. Maybe
that's
it's just
right.
going to go away.
That's right.
And so I'm always playing the odds.
That's right.
And I don't want to take too much medication. I don't
that's
like taking
right.
medication. But if I wait too long, it might be too late. So
right.
you tell me what I should be doing.
See that all the time.
Uh-huh.
All right. And I'll tell you, and I'm not saying you do or don't, but we see that most often in people who have migraine. Okay?
Mm.
In other words, if you've got a headache that's really severe enough for you to really worry about becoming bad enough to affect your functioning, it may not make you dysfunctional, but it certainly may, let's take a 0 to 100% scale. And I would say that if you find that these headaches can affect you 50 or 60% or more, then you may be dealing with migraine if you think about the symptoms we said before. Now, if you have migraine, one of the reasons that some people with intermittent migraine evolve to chronic daily is because they become so frightened of being debilitated that they medicate as early as possible with their mild attacks. If they start to do that too often, they can generate these rebound headaches. Again, 3 or more times a week, I think, is the cutoff. Now, here's what I think you need to do. I think you need to find out whether or not, indeed, these are migraine. And if they are, what I would suggest is that you try to use some of the non-pharmacological techniques if you have the time to implement them for the mild headaches, because you're going to find that not every mild headache turns into a migraine. You know, for example, it's like snapping your fingers and saying, "What are you doing?" And I say, "Well, I'm keeping the elephants away. You see any elephants here? Must be working." So there may be a little of that effect going on here with that. But certainly at other times, taking the medicine early into the episode can be very helpful. What you need to have really, Terry, is a backup medication, maybe going up to prescription medication for the more severe attacks you have. So instead of chasing it with medication over a few days, you can get rid of it more quickly.
Let's talk about food triggers. Now, I'm very confused about caffeine because on the one hand, I know caffeine can help ward off a headache. On the other hand, I know caffeine can help bring on a headache. So I'm utterly confused.
Okay. Well, welcome to the club. With caffeine, first of all, let's understand the role of caffeine in the United States. The average consumption for about 85% of Americans of caffeine daily is 200 milligrams. Let's put that in perspective. What's 200 milligrams? Your average 5-ounce cup of brewed or drip coffee, caffeinated, is anywhere from 120 to 160 milligrams a day of caffeine, okay? So a cup and a half of 5-ounce coffee is about 200 milligrams a day. Now, if I say to people, "Well, how much coffee do you drink a day?" They'll say, "Well, I don't know, 2 or 3 cups." And then the next question is, cups or mugs? And you know what the answer is, mugs.
Right.
Which are about twice as much. So if we begin to look at that, and maybe they take a cola or two during the day, you're starting to talk about a fairly significant amount of caffeine. All right, now here's the story as far as headache is concerned. A small amount of caffeine or a moderate amount of caffeine taken at the time of the headache can be clearly very helpful for a number of reasons. In migraine, it may be useful because caffeine can constrict blood vessels. Caffeine is added to several over-the-counter medications and many prescription medications because it does two things. It speeds up the absorption of the medication, and it also acts as what we call an adjuvant. In other words, the addition of caffeine to either aspirin or acetaminophen plus aspirin increases the pain-relieving properties of those medications. So we know that. The problem is, if you're taking in caffeine in fairly large amounts, and that can vary from person to person, there are some without realizing it who are pretty sensitive to it, this is what happens. You take your caffeine in through the day, Your caffeine levels are up there. You don't have caffeine. Your caffeine levels are falling. Blood vessels are dilating. And then your body is calling for more caffeine. Even in patients who don't have migraine, if they're taking in fair amounts of caffeine on a daily basis, and on Saturday morning they get up later, or they drink less coffee on the weekend, they can get a withdrawal headache from caffeine. If you're unfortunate enough to have migraine and are doing this, that withdrawal from the caffeine can actually trigger migraine. So what we generally do is you have two choices. One is to maintain a high level of caffeine intake, get up the same time every day and continue taking it. I don't advocate that because there are some adverse consequences of high levels of caffeine. What I do advocate is getting down slowly, and I recommend that people do this slowly, no more than one half mug or 1 5-ounce cup per 5 to 7 days. I'd like to see people get down to 1 5-ounce cup of caffeinated coffee each morning and the rest decaf if they must drink.
No, I know the last time you were here, you told us red wine is a particular trigger.
Right.
But in your new book, you recommend drinking a lot of water if you're drinking an alcoholic beverage. How can you offset the effects of alcohol by drinking water?
Well, what we're saying is that for most patients, alcohol is clearly a trigger. What the addition of water does, you know, alcohol is a diuretic. And one of the reasons we get hangover headaches is because of the diuretic effects of alcohol, which then leads to dehydration. So if you're taking in lots of water at the same time that you're taking in alcohol, you're going to increase the hydration that you're losing from the alcohol, and also you're going to get less toxic effects from the alcohol, and you're diluting it somewhat. The major triggers alcohol-wise are really red wine and beer, but really most patients with migraine can have a problem with any of them.
So how much water should you drink?
Eight glasses a day, we like. You know, as a general rule, it's good for your kidneys anyway. So I think that taking in 8 glasses of water a day is very useful. I think we talked about NutraSweet, contained in most diet beverages. That's aspartame. It's the main artificial sweetener. In 50% of patients, it can trigger attacks. And I think that MSG can be a problem for some patients as well. And most of the time, MSG is not even labeled as MSG. Look at your bag of potato chips and other things. It may say hydrolyzed fat, hydrolyzed protein. There's a wonderful book by George Schwartz called In Bad Taste, which talks about all the hidden areas where MSG is found. Some people think it's because of the salt they're taking in, but if you read the bag of potato chips, you're going to find MSG in a lot of them that aren't natural.
But salt can be a trigger, too.
Yeah, with salt can be a factor for some patients. It's not a very common trigger for a headache, but it can be in some patients. You know, especially for women around their period, if you take in a lot of salt, you're bound to have a great deal of water retention, which can increase some of the premenstrual symptoms that they have.
What about sugar?
Sugar is a problem, or can be, especially large amounts, because when you take in sugar, especially in large amounts, there's a rebound effect. When you take in sugar, your pancreas secrete insulin. Often it may oversecrete, and then your sugar levels end up dropping, and you may get a very mild or relative hypoglycemia, which in migraine-prone patients can sometimes trigger it. So taking in lots of sugar at one sitting is not a great idea, even though it's craved during menses and chocolate.
My guest is headache expert Dr. Fred Cheftel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Now, if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Fred Cheftel, and he is the co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and he's also the president of the American Council for Headache Education. He's co-author of the new book, Headache Relief for Women. Now, your new book contains a lot of information about menstrual cycles and headaches and pregnancy and headaches and so on. So let's get into some of that. How does headache relate to a woman's hormone levels?
Well, as we've known, clearly the ratio in migraine goes up 3 to 1 after puberty. It's really because of the nature of cyclical estrogens. During a woman's normal hormonal cycle, estrogens go up and down. Now, estrogens can have an indirect effect on blood vessel activity, and it's really clear now that the changing levels of estrogen also have an effect on brain chemistry, and when they are falling, it can increase susceptibility to incoming pain stimuli. Well, we've known from studies from years ago that it's the fall of estrogen, which occurs premenstrually and to some extent during ovulation, that can make women who have a vulnerability for migraine susceptible to it at that time. We know, for example, that during pregnancy, Terry, that 75% of women with migraine feel great. Why is that? The reason is that during pregnancy, going into your fourth month, estrogens are sustained at a high level. They do not fluctuate. Then you talk about going into menopause, and around menopause, there are more fluctuations around the perimenopausal area involving estrogen and progesterone that can affect the woman adversely. Then you talk about the issue of hormone replacement. That's controversial enough, but there are ways of replacing hormones in migrainous women that will make them worse and ways of replacing it that make them better. Unfortunately, too many OBGYN doctors are not necessarily sensitive to the issue of migraine. They don't truly understand how debilitating it can be, and they replace estrogens the way they do for non-migrainous women, and that can be a disaster.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is this, is that most of the time the way estrogens are replaced postmenopausally is kind of mimicking the menstrual cycle. So you're put on estrogen, for example, Premarin, Estrace, the estrogen patch, days 1 through 21 or 1 through 25. And then you're put on progesterone someplace in there as well, either days 1 through 10 or 15 through 25. Every woman who's on the cyclical replacement with migraine dreads going on the progesterone because they know when they go on that, the likelihood is they're going to get killed as far as migraine is concerned. So the problem is that women who still have their uteri intact really need to take progesterone to protect them against the cancer potential of the estrogens as far as the uteruses are concerned. So here's the way we do it. If you have your uterus intact, we recommend that the estrogens be given on a daily basis, that they not be cycled. We also recommend that the progesterone be given in smaller doses on a daily basis as well. It gives you the advantage of the protection you need, and it also gives you the advantage of stopping the cycling, which is the major issue. Sometimes you may need to switch to different types of hormone replacement if you find that your headaches are not doing well with the first type. And OBGYN people have to be open to listening to that. And I usually give our women patients articles to give to their gynecologist. And I find at that point the gynecologist is more open to looking at the issue and is generally very receptive to making the changes that we suggest based on all the literature on estrogens, progesterones in women.
If a woman's headaches seem to be related to changes in hormones during her menstrual cycle or related to menopause, does that mean she should be treating her headache differently than other people?
Yes, to some extent. And the reason is this, is we know that the migraines that are associated directly with the menstrual cycle are more difficult to treat by and large than those not associated with the cycle. Even the same woman, her non-menstrual attacks respond much better to medication than her menstrual attacks. There's some evidence that medicines like Imitrex seem to work as well during the menstrual cycle. Now, because it involves hormones, Terry, there are some subtle things that one can do around that time of the month hormonally that may be helpful and not dangerous. For example, I said that the reason that women are prone to these headaches around the period is related to falling estrogen. We may put them on a very, very tiny dose of the estrogen patch around their period, which doesn't really affect their period, but prevents the estrogens from falling and can really delay the headache or even prevent it from occurring. So there are some special maneuvers around menses time that can be done. Sometimes we may just use a non-steroidal medication like Anaprox a couple of times a day going into the period once we have that headache timed, and that can be helpful. So there are some perimenstrual regimens that are available, and we talk about them in the book as well.
I want to look at some non-drug-oriented ways of dealing with headache. One of the things you recommend is aerobic exercise. Why does that help?
Well, exercise in general is very helpful. Number one, It really is a mechanism whereby people can really do good things for their cardiovascular system, increase that efficiency, ways in which they can maintain their weight, ways in which they could really help to get rid of stress that may exist in their lives. And by the way, let me just interject this, is that there are many people I see, both women and men, who tell me that they get great exercise when they go out and play tennis, or they go out and play golf even, which is not a lot of exercise. However, when you watch some people, and you've seen this, who are out there playing tennis or golf, they are so incredibly competitive that you wonder if relaxation seems to be the furthest thing from their mind. So I really like people to be involved in kind of non-competitive exercise where they really can take a few minutes to smell the roses, so to speak, and be more in touch with their surroundings and their bodies. Second thing is that exercise increases levels of these chemicals called endorphins, which are morphine-like substances that naturally occur in the body, which are great, great pain relievers. And doing it, exercise on a regular basis helps to increase our metabolism and helps to increase the level of endorphins. So I find that to be very useful. It's a good way for people to get away from other things that they're doing. Take care of yourself as well as you take care of other people. That's helpful as well. So we're big advocates of exercise.
As a preventive.
As a preventive, yep, for general health.
Now tell me what kind of success you've had with these things, a massage, acupuncture, hypnosis, biofeedback.
We've had varying degrees of success with all of those modalities, but I think what people have to understand is that, you know, they'll talk to other patients who say, oh, hypnosis did it for me, oh, acupuncture did it for me. Unfortunately, the same modality does not work for every given person. So we're open to trying a variety of these things. We need to combine both pharmacological and non-pharmacological approaches. Acupuncture and acupressure can be helpful for some. Self-hypnosis, relaxation, biofeedback can be helpful for others. Exercise, diet manipulation, vitamins. There are certain vitamins and herbs that can be helpful for some patients. And we like patients to really try to use a potpourri of these non-pharmacological approaches as well.
Do you think we're going to have a real cure for headaches sometime in the near future?
I think that we will be looking, probably, I would say that based on what's going on with what we're understanding about the genetics and molecular biology, that we may be close in the first 20 years of the next millennium to actually finding a cure for these disorders if we can still get enough government money to support the research that's going on.
Be nice to have a cure.
It would be great to have a cure. But in the meantime, right now, today, we can control it to a great degree.
Dr. Cheftel, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Perry. Always, Terry.
Dr. Fred Cheftel is the co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and national president of AACE, the American Council for Headache Education. He's the co-author of the new book, Headache Relief for Women. This is Fresh Air. Ron Hansen's novel Mariette in Ecstasy has been made into a film starring Mary McDonnell. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that his new novel, Atticus, would make a good suspense picture, but that's only half the story.
Reading Ron Hansen's work transports me back to a morning in third grade when my teacher, Sister Mary William, was explaining the concept of sacred mysteries to my class. These weren't mysteries, she said, like Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys. Instead, they were mysteries of faith that were incomprehensible to human reason. Contemplating them, she promised, would add a profound dimension to our lives. I liked this eerie notion of mysteries that couldn't be understood by us mere mortals, and so that theology lesson always stuck with me, as it most certainly stuck with Ron Hansen. Hansen also grew up Catholic and last year earned a master's degree in spirituality from Santa Clara University. In 1991, he witnessed a commercial miracle when his novel, Mariette in Ecstasy, became an unlikely bestseller. I say unlikely because this was a story about a nun suffering from the stigmata, the bleeding wounds of the crucified Christ. Hansen's just-published novel, Atticus, chronicles a father's search for the truth about his son's death. But just as Mariette in Ecstasy used the stigmata phenomenon to probe the sacred mystery of religious belief, Atticus uses the secular murder mystery form as a cover story to explore the sacred mystery of the bond between a parent and child. Like Sister Mary William promised, contemplating this sacred mystery in the incarnation of Atticus is an enriching experience. Atticus Cody, the eponymous hero of Hansen's novel, is a 67-year-old Colorado rancher with two grown sons. His firstborn son, Frank, is a state senator. His prodigal son, 40-year-old Scott, is an unsuccessful artist living in Mexico on money inherited from his mother. Many years earlier, she was killed in a car crash. Scott was driving. The novel opens at Christmas time when Scott surprises Atticus with a visit. All the ways Scott and his level-headed father excruciatingly misunderstand each other are compacted into the gifts they exchange. Scott gives his dad a luxury wristwatch. Thrifty Atticus gives Scott an off-brand cassette player. Soon after Scott returns to Mexico, Atticus receives a phone call informing him that Scott has committed suicide. He flies down to Resurrección, the tourist town where Scott lived the Malcolm Lowry life of a drunken exile. And from there on in, the mood of this novel mutates into classic film noir. Strange men's clothes are found in Scott's closet. A plane ticket to Germany is delivered, reserved in Scott's name, for a flight scheduled after his suicide. And a beggar wanders the town wearing Scott's college T-shirt. Following a purging bout of Montezuma's revenge, Atticus realizes in his churned-up gut that Scott has been murdered. As he investigates, Atticus learns that trying to find out the truth about the kind of man his son was like trying to hold water in your hands. There was a point two-thirds of the way through this plot where I thought Hansen had lost his nerve, that he was turning this elliptical and mournful novel into a conventional whodunit. Oh, me of little faith! Yes, there is an ingenious, rational solution here to the murder, but the deeper spiritual questions Hansen's novel raises about the limits of human forgiveness and the power of a father's love are answered in an ending so moving, so magical, it'll give even the most cynical of readers a reason to believe.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Atticus, a new novel by Ron Hansen. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf, Joan Tuohy-Westman, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Marina Bander. I'm Terry Gross, and before I go, I have some music for this Valentine's Day. On past Valentine's Days, I've closed the show with my favorite recordings of My Funny Valentine by Tony Bennett and Chet Baker. Well, this year I have a song that's about yearning for love. It's called Something to Live For. It was written by Billy Strayhorn, Duke Ellington's close collaborator. Strayhorn is at the piano, accompanying singer Carmen McRae, recorded in 1955.
My life an adventurous dream. Oh, what wouldn't I give for someone who'd take my life and make it seem gay, as they say it ought to be.
My eye.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Dinosaur in a Haystack, Reflections in Natural History by Stephen Jay Gould, a Harmony book. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.